You are listening to a podcast by the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust.
The views expressed in this podcast are those of the individual contributor and not necessarily those of HMDT.
In this podcast, we talk to Var Hong Ash. Var is the author of From Phnom Penh to Paradise and Survived the Cambodian Genocide. She has lived in the UK since 1979.
So, Val, can I ask you, what was life like for you in Cambodia before the Khmer Rouge took power?
Well, before the Khmer Rouge took power, life to me, personally, with my family, wasn't very bad. Considering there were a lot of poverty around, due to the civil war, due to the high rate of inflation, the salary could no longer afford people, enough to eat. But to me, because me and my husband, in order to make ends meet, we both have additional job on the side. So we were able to live, not very comfortably, but we were okay, I can say that. It's quite ironic because, around you there's a lot of, around us, there were lots of refugees from the provinces. They build shacks and little shelter along the road and didn't have anything to eat, and children had no education, and there were a lot of suffering, lots of poverty before 1975. Before the Khmer Rouge took over.
What was your family life like?
As I said, we're okay. We're not struggling as bad as many other families around us. Our day-to-day life, we kind of have three or four generations in our house. My mother was there with us because she lived in the province south of Phnom Penh, and she escaped to the city. So my auntie was there, and her family, her children, her great-grandchildren, and me and my children were there. So we all crammed in our... Well, it used to be enough room for us, but our very cramped house, everybody sleep on the floor and build a little shelter around in the garden. So me going to work every day, earning, the normal salary, because they don't raise your salary, which can afford, probably 10% of what we need for our everyday life. Yeah, that's a salary.
So what was it like when the Khmer Rouge did take power? Were people excited?
When the Khmer Rouge took over, and the people, at that time I wasn't in my house, we escaped even in Phnom Penh itself. I was living, my house was at the suburb of Phnom Penh. Even then, we escaped to a townhouse, sort of an apartment in the middle of the city that belonged to a friend. So we were, there when the Khmer Rouge came in, their tanks and everything, and people were sort of flying, used their sheet, white sheet, and flying white flag, to welcome the Khmer Rouge, and we all really were very, very happy. We knew that, what the Khmer Rouge was going to do with us, what they were like and everything, but it's just that we were so fed up with the old regime, with the hard life, with the corruption, and everything, and we thought, you know, a change would be a new fresh air for us. So we were so happy.
So how did the rest of your family react? Were they the same?
Well, we were packing up to go home. And at that time, my father, my brother, who was a lieutenant in my father's army, my father was colonel in the army, and he looks after a regiment who fighting outside Phnom Penh. So my brother ran home first, and my father had to stay with the troop. And so we were packing up from then, you know, when the Khmer Rouge came in, we said, that's it, you know, we're going to be peaceful again. And so we were packing up to go home. And my brother, who knew about the situation better than us, and said, no, don't go yet. Let me go out and assess the situation. So he would go out, in and out, and came back and tell a story, which from bad to worse, you know, saying that no, not do anything yet. It doesn't look as though it's going to be, you know, like what we all thought. So we continue to stay. And it's only the second day that we were told that the Khmer Rouge ordered everybody on their way in, you know, to the capital to get out of their house, to go into the countryside. And their excuse for that is they need time, they need space to look for imperialist, capitalist army who could be hiding in our house and form a rebel against them, okay? So my brothers kind of said to me, don't go yet, you know, wait until the dust settled down a little bit. So we were hiding in the house, in the apartment. And because we had enough stock of food and the running water still running, so we thought we can survive on that. Until the second, third days, and we were surprised by the Khmer Rouge who came in through the roof with gun pointing at us. And that was our first encounter with the Khmer Rouge. And I must say, it's quite frightening having gun pointed at you by men in black and just appeared from nowhere. So that was... That was enough to force us out. You know, we wouldn't die anymore. And
so did everybody leave together? You had to move out?
Yeah, we lived together. But because I came from the suburb and I packed everything in my car and I just left everything in my car. And so we didn't have to pack a lot, you know. And so we only packed food and a bit of dry fish and when?
So when you're leaving the city, you know, do you know where you're going?
No. Nobody knew. It was a complete chaos. We saw people pushing the bicycle, pushing the car, you know, all over. It was complete chaos. And at one point, you know, the Khmer Rouge decided that, you know, they have to just, you know, organize it. So they, you know, they just push us in whatever direction they want us to go. So we went in a direction that we didn't even want to go. So we went in there. And that was the beginning of our nightmare.
How long did it take you to get to wherever it was that you were going?
That is a story in itself. It took us more than a month because we were forcing west. When we wanted to go south, where my mother's family was. And so we kind of tried to, you know, without the Khmer Rouge, trying to edge my way, our way toward the south instead. But it was when we called that, because you wouldn't believe it, because that's the, if you see the killing field, you know, what we call the human traffic jam, because millions, 2 millions of people were forced out of the city. And on the road, which is like you go to, you know, Oxford Street during, you know, before Christmas, it's just like packed like jam like that. And I call it nightmare. It's not just the, you know, the jam, the human traffic jam. It's just that you were saying children lost. Their parents got lost. They cry, they scream. And all the people couldn't walk and cry. And some people just carrying their elderly parent on the hammock, you know. And some women gave birth along the side of the road without help, screaming, calling for help. Somebody help me out in the birth. And people were forced out of the hospital. Stomach still had their stomach open without, not yet, you know, sewn up. And bleeding, and relatives, you know, pushed them in, still, you know, on their hospital bed, you know, alongside. And some died there. And every now and then we would see corpse of soldiers who were shot by the Khmer Rouge, or of, you know, civilian people were shot by the Khmer Rouge for protesting or for not obeying the order. And then we had to stop from time to time because it happened during April. And April is the hottest month of the year. So under the, you know, burning heat, you know, people can't walk very fast. You just walk a few hundred yards or something like that. You would find a shade, you know, to stop and cook whatever you carry with you, or find water or whatever it is. So that is why it took us more than a month to reach a little village south of Phnom Penh, where it was the birthplace of my mother, to, you know, stop.
It was her decision.
Yeah, well, we had no, it was her decision, and we all agree, because you rather go to somewhere where you know the people rather than go to somewhere completely new to you. So, yeah.
And what happened when you got there?
When we got there, you see, it's, we still, you know, carry on hoping that they will let us go back, because that what the Khmer Rouge said to us, said that it's only for 3 days, okay, and that more than a month already, but we still keep hoping that, well, you know, to try to organize the whole country, it takes time, so just hang on there, okay. So as soon as we arrived to the village, the chief of the village, which had, well, they were normal people like us, but because the Khmer Rouge took over, you know, people outside before us, months before us, they kind of settled down, and they kind of sort of were in a flow of whatever, you know, organization that the Khmer Rouge, you know, formed for us. In the morning, they would get up, what they do and who doing what and everything. So they came and talked to us and tried to brainwash us, that, you know, that said, you know, that we should be happy with the new revolution, that now we're free from the American, we're free from the capitalist people, imperialist people, and now we are all equal, that kind of propaganda. So they would, you know, say to us, right, tomorrow you would go and do this. This person will come and get you and then lead you to the working place. So because it's a dry season, so we were asked to do the digging canal, to dig the to chop out forest, you know, making space for growing trees and, you know, that kind of thing. So we were okay then, and there were no killing at that point.
So and how did it develop from there then? Were there people from the Cameroon who came in and started organizing you?
Yes, from there, I think, you know, at that time, you know, they were because they were busy coping with the big scale of trying to organize the whole country. So they, and then, you know, probably, you know, what they call psychological war, they still trying to win, you know, our brain, you know, that they were good and everything. But eventually there must have been, not in, you know, not that I know of, because that you don't know what's going on, but there must have been some people who protest against them and everything when, you know, their martial law started. And and then when we heard of the rumor that people were taken away and were killed, yeah, and until then, you know, I didn't know that being a teacher, because I was a teacher, being a teacher could, you know, get me killed as well. So, you know, from every now and then, they would come at least with a list, and, you know, they do a survey, you know, trying to say how many people live in this village, you know, and they try to get enough rice to feed us, that kind of thing. So I still put my name on as a teacher and, you know, everything, because I never believed for one second that a country could be run without a teacher, without, you know, engineer, without doctor, you know, that kind of thing. So I couldn't believe it. And we were lucky because the village, it was my, as I said, my mother's birthplace. And my grandmother, who was born there as well, and she was a midwife, and she was well loved by the villager. And I think, I don't know, it might not be right, but I think due to that, that I was spared, yeah. Because, not due to that, but other thing as well, because I work, I do what they ask me to do. And I was very enthusiastic about things. You know, not a moment that I would just say, well, no, I'm not going to do it. You know, I'm not used to it. You know, I'm a teacher. I'm, you know, I will belong to a middle class family in the past. So, and this is, you know, like I said, it's due to my mother, because of her village, her relative there must have, you know, sort of whispered to her secretly that, you know, this is the way to survive, because they experienced that before us. The Khmer Rouge took over their village before they took over the, you know, they go in from the outside. And then because of my mother's advice and encouragement, you know, that's how we put up with, you know, hard working and say nothing and just head down and work hard. That's how we survive, I think. Yeah.
So did you witness people being taken away from the village then?
Not then. Mm-hmm. Not then. But eventually, yes. Not then. But we heard of it. We heard of it.
Was it important for you to forget that you were a teacher?
Oh, yeah, I was told by the relative there. Again, they didn't say it right out because they were afraid for their life as well. They would just say that, well, you know, I think it's safer that you forget your old identity. because there's no turning back now. They do really, truly believe that. So it's only two classes now in Cambodia, working class and Ongka. That's it. Ongka is our leader and we are working people. That's it. I didn't give up hope then, but, you know, to survive, I do what I was advised to do.
So that's the beginning, really?
Yeah.
The first, what, 6 months?
Well, you know, you might wonder, well, you know, why didn't they kill you if I told them, honestly, that I was a teacher? But I don't even have... I didn't even have to tell them. They know who we were. So why we survived then? But again, you know, I repeat myself again, you know, due to my mother's encouragement, advice, and maybe we were treated slightly different from other people because of my mother's and my grandmother's, you know, being, reputation and being, you know, family there and everything. But from then on, you know, I was born, and so I behave accordingly, you know, what they want me to behave. Not only that I survived, I nearly got killed twice, but it was a blessing in disguise because of that. I was very careful, and I survived then. But I think had I continued to stay in that village, I would have been killed eventually, because the Ongka is the body of the Khmer Rouge, we call it Ongka. The authority, this is, you know, I learned afterward, they keep changing the Khmer Rouge body of the village. They keep changing. They take people, even the Khmer Rouge themselves, they don't trust themselves among themselves. They keep changing, you know, the Khmer Rouge from this village to go to another, and the other came. And had I stayed on, I would have been killed anyway, because my name as a teacher was on the list in that village. Anyway, because of their policy, they keep moving people from what we were called new people. Okay, they kept moving new people from one town to another, and they split us, you know, half to this village and half to this village, and the other half here and the other half come back here. So they just keep breaking our group. So we wouldn't trust each other, we wouldn't be able to form, you know, anything against them. So my family were evacuated from the south of Cambodia to the north of Cambodia. And we had another thing, you know, story in itself. We were put on a train, you know, and it's only about 500 kilometers from where we are to where they want us to be. But it took us 3 days. The train was packed like sardine in order to save the fuel, in order, you know, to security, in order to be able to have a full control on us. They put us all in one train. I don't know how many cars, how many... carriages in that, but it was altogether 3,000 of us in one train, and it took 3 days, and that was a nightmare in itself. People die on the train, and they wouldn't stop for us to bury the dead, you know, the dead eventually started to smell, and they have to throw it through the window of the train. Babies, elderly people mostly. And then we were stopped twice for us to get out along the side of the train to cook, you know, whatever we have. And one of the days they gave us a French baguette. That's all we were given. No water, nothing. And so you can imagine how hard it was. People died from dehydration, from diseases, from tiring. Because we were like starting 3 days. Nobody, you can't lie down or sleep. You're standing, sleeping, or leaning against wall, leaning towards each other. And so anyway, so eventually we arrived to the place. And then when I was able to change my identity. But even so, I nearly got caught once. We were queued up for their survey, and I spotted my husband's friend, you know, who were the official there. And I was so happy that they might take me on and you give me my teacher's job back. And I greeted him, and he, you know, in a very offhanded way, you know, he said, "Oh, okay, hello, what's your name?" And everything. So I told him again my identity. And I was told after that they were looking for me. But after queuing up, you know, like everybody else, you scatter into little group, try to find firework to cook rice, because they give us rice, raw rice, and to cook rice to eat. So we have to find any shelter, because it was so hot, remember? It was hot. Any shelter to cook, and they couldn't find me. And I was so disappointed that they couldn't find me. Because I was so adamant that that friend, who is a very close friend of my husband, would try to find me to help me. But no, just as well.
So when you're up there now in the north, so you put back to work?
Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And is that where you spent the rest of the period?
We were still moved around. From one village to another, but still in the north. Okay, we were eventually moved to the jungle, because I was in a province, you know, and in a town, in a quite a decent sized town, and you know, where there were authority, we had enough to, well, when I say enough to eat, it's just enough to survive, you know, they give us enough, and then we were allowed to go out and dig all the roots and do some little fishing, find some little shrimp or little frog or whatever, you know, crickets or whatever, we ate anything. When you're hungry, you know, people might not understand it. But we eat anything. And then some people even got killed because they picked, because the ration, the rice that they gave us, it's just so small, it's not enough. And when you have to work so hard, you spend a lot of calorie, and then you need more, but you don't. And so people getting thinner, paler and paler. Girls don't have any period anymore, because you just, you know, your body just have enough to keep you going. And so some of what people pick live that they don't know, and they got poisoned and died just from that. So life was so cheap under the Khmer Rouge, because, you know, because I was ill, you know, at one point I was really, really, really ill. And my family, because I was with my brother being killed, and all the teenager were sent away, you know, because they split the family. To begin with, they split the group, okay, and then eventually they split the family. You know, older people who got children stay in the village. Teenager girl split to one side. Teenager boy got splinter, and then grown up men to one side. So I was there with my mother, who was blind, and my two young daughters, yeah, too little. And because I was ill, I wasn't useful to them anymore. So they evacuated me and my mother to a village quite remote in the jungle. You see nothing. There's no truck, you know. We were go, you know, the transport that we had to go there was on the ox cart. And we were there, and I was nearly died lying on that. My mother being blind, can't walk, so they put my mother next to me, and I was so quiet. And according to my mother, I was, you know, in and out of consciousness. And my mother kept, had it not been for my mother, I would have died, covering me, keep shaking me, asking me whether I'm all right, giving me water, you know, that sort of thing. And the journey took more than a day. Okay, we started at about 5 o'clock in the morning, and then we wouldn't arrive there until after midnight. And by the time I was there, I had to be carried out of the ox cart to the house. They already have a house, you know, not, there's nothing organized like you hear, you know. You're there, they would call, you know, one of the houses, you know, have you got somebody, new people yet? And I was the last one to find a house, because nobody wanted me. I'm nearly dead. Nobody wanted me to lie in their house. So that was, you know, I sort of survived that time as well. Thanks to my mother. You know, from every now and then, they would have a young man, a young boy, or whatever, tie, okay, blindfolded, and they would march that. And one Khmer Rouge in the front, one in the back, both holding machete, you know, big knife like that. And they parade the boy, you know, in every single little pathway in the village. And we all sort of watch it in horror. And they do that as, they did that as a warning to us. If you dare to run away, or if you dare not obeying our order, that's what happened to you. And that happened very often in the village. Because the village is, I didn't know exactly, it's close to the border. And there were many people who ran, you know, tried to escape and would escape past the village. Yeah. And that is why we saw it often. And during the dry season, we were asked to go into the forest to cut some kind of hay, you know, to make thatch to, you know, for the roof, because there's no roof like this. The roof was made from, it's a thatch roof. And during the dry season, people would go into the forest, cut the thatch, dry it, and then make it into a sort of like a sheet. And we were asked, and we encountered a few open mass graves. Because to begin with, we were attracted by the smell, and people said, there must be someone got killed near there. And we walked and we saw a mass grave with full of corpse rotten away there. And that was horrible, horrible. And you just collapse on your feet because the emotion was so high. So high or so bad, you know, that you just said, oh, and so nobody, you know, we were just all speechless, look at each other, walk back with a deep, deep, sad feeling in our heart, and just continue working. And I stayed in that village for more than a year. A lot has happened, but eventually they evacuated us again to another place. And then when the Khmer Rouge, the Vietnamese were invading the country, and then when the Khmer Rouge were themselves running into the forest, into the mountain and everything. And that was the beginning of my escape. Because in the village nearby, there was a man, because, you know, I find out later it's only about 10, 15 miles from the village to the Thai border. Yeah. So now, and then in the olden time, people crossing the border, the Thai crossing, and the Khmer people cross the border to Thailand, they do trade, you know, they have things, you know. And there's a Khmer man there who used to, he has a house in, he had a house in Thailand near the border, but he came in and out, you know, to see his family and everything. And then during the Khmer Rouge time, he got stuck there. But at one point when the Khmer Rouge was out of control, you know, he came in and tried to get his family. And he was known to people in Thailand to have taken people out of the country. And then someone who was a former pilot ask him, pay him money, and ask him to find their family. And he came in, and of course he get his family to look for that lady. His family happened to be someone like me, because the man got a picture. She looked like me, but a different name, of course. And she got two daughters, the same age as, similar age as my daughter. And she got an auntie who is blind. And he came, the family came to me and said, look, your husband, you know, asked my brother to try to get you out of here to Thailand. And I didn't believe it. I said, look, my name is not that. And my children are not bad, and it's my mother who blind, not my auntie, okay? I was totally honest. And they said, yeah, we know everybody changed their name, everybody changed their identity, and you don't have to be worried. We are honest, we are real. And I still believe them. And I talked to my mother, and my mother's, you know, Think, and she said, look at it this way. If they were Khmer Rouge, if they want to kill you, nothing stopped them to come and take you and kill. And now the Khmer Rouge, this is another long story, because of my association with the Vietnamese, because I speak French, I speak Vietnamese, so I was able to talk to the Vietnamese people and ask for medicine for my mother and ask for food. So the villager was jealous, and they reported to the Khmer Rouge. And although the Khmer Rouge were out of the control, they were in and out of the village at night time. And they were told about me, and they were looking for me to be killed. And my mother said, because they said I was a spy of the Vietnamese, my mother said, you better go, because you stay here, you have more chance of being killed by the Khmer Rouge. And if you go, and I don't think it was the Khmer Rouge who tricked you to kill, if they want to kill you, they now they know where you are. They kill you anyway. So because of that, I decided to follow them. And that was my escape. And the escape took more than a day. Looking back, I don't know how I would have survived. We went to Thailand, okay, and then we were he disappeared, but he leave some few tips that, you know, if people, the authority, the Thai authority come to you, just say that, you know, you can't leave and, you know, you were tortured, whatever it is, you know, whatever is happening, and you can't be there anymore, that is why you're here. So when we were there, so we were taken to another, you know, in the army truck to a camp, a refugee camp near the border. And unfortunately for us at that time, the Thai, you know, decided, Thai authority decided that they won't take any more refugee. And so they consider us as illegal refugee. So they gathered all the people who came during that period of time. I don't know started from when, but I was one of them, you know, to send back. And they sent back truck full of people of that group back to Cambodia. And the way they did it, they put the people in army truck, and they went to a highest one at the border, you know, cliff, and they just tilt the truck, and people just come down there. It's just like you tilted rubbish. Needless to say, children and older people die. If they don't die then, they will die later, because it's from, you know, wild animal, from thirst, from hungry, from getting lost in the forest. Only very few made their way back. And one of the few was one of my ex-brother-in-law. He's now in Australia, right? Now, I escaped again. And this is due to my illness. Before the escape, I'm going backward now, before the leaving Cambodia, there was a dead cow die, and people were hungry, so they pull it in, and, you know, I don't know how many people, and they just get a bit of meat out of the cow and cook it in. And I was one of them. And because I was so weak, I was not very strong, I was not very clever, like skillful like other people, I cut my hand. And I was one of the two people out of, I don't know, 100 people who did that, who got illness. Because by cutting that, the whatever bacteria or the germ, whatever, in the cow went into my bloodstream. And that was happening a few days before my escape through the jungle. And I already had a very high fever before escaping. During the escape, I was feeling terrible because of the fever. But the adrenaline was so high. Fear, the, you know, of being left behind in the jungle, you know, you have to follow the crowd and that sort of thing, and having two daughters to look after and everything, you know, you just went on through the adrenaline, not through your own physical strength. And as soon as I got to the camp, I was really, really ill. And this hand was swollen that big, that I had to cut the sleeve, you know, in order to. And because of that, one of the British, young British relief worker took me out of the camp, because that camp was quite a makeshift camp, so there's no medical facility. He actually asked the authority, the Thai authority, who was a very good friend of his, said that, can I save her? Because otherwise she will die. And then he said, yes, you can. take her, but bring her back because she needed to be sent back. So I was taken out of that camp to the other camp. And when they came and took people to send back, they missed me because I was in another camp. You see, I was very lucky, you know, that's
you mean
what...
Your daughter's with you?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yeah, you know, I was sure that they were with me. And then they even took me to the... because I was in a coma for, I think, for 3 days. And so they took me from the camp to the Thai real hospital in a very isolated room because they were, I was diagnosed with having anthrax. And I was on a heavy dose of penicillin and everything, so they decided, the Thai people, they don't care, you know, I was a refugee, decided that, you know, in order to save their room, the place, and the work of their doctor and everything, they decided to chop, amputate my hand. That young British man who eventually became my husband, Robert Ash, felt sorry for me, said, well, you know, don't do anything yet. So he took in an American doctor who was working for another, you know, charity organization. And he, you know, decided to do this and do that. And I don't know, I was most of the time unconscious. I was really, really ill. And somebody in the camp helped looking after the girls. So I was by myself in the hospital and everything. So eventually, because of that American doctor, I don't know what he gave me. So when my conditions bit sort of better, they sent me back to the camp. And I was hiding all the time. And at that time, although I was accepted because people knew the international relief organizations, many of them knew about my situation because of so many hundred died from being sent back. So they were helping me. They tried to get me out of the camp, you know, but they just couldn't. I was accepted to go to France. Because I speak French, I was accepted to Australia, I was accepted to go to America, because, you know, you speak the language, it's easier. But no one can take me out of the camp legally, because my name wasn't on the legal list as legal refugee. I was on an illegal refugee, nobody could take me out. That was a problem. I prayed and prayed and prayed, and Robert was trying to help. Robert is English. So at that time, the British people never took any Cambodian refugee. They took both people, Vietnamese refugee, but never, not one Cambodian refugee come to England. And British people don't want any refugee from Cambodia. Robert contacted his father, and his father contacted television company. They went out and interviewed me. At that time, Kurt Waldman, who was the UN General Secretary, heard about the people, hundreds of people were killed, being sent back in my group, went to the camp where I was to visit, to sort of highlight things, to try to stop the Thai people from sending the people, the refugee back, and to be killed. At that time, my daughter, my little daughter, who was 5 or 6 years old at the time, didn't know what was going on, saw somebody and with a lot of, you know, security guard around, with a high official around. She went in, through people's legs, and people didn't see her because she's so small. Went in to Kurt Waldman, hold on to his hand. Hello, hello. Okay, he picked her up, carried her, and the whole, all the press got that picture and she was stated, I got a cutting somewhere. My daughter, one of the refugees who were to be sent back to Cambodia, you know, that changed everything. My Robert, you know, talked to his friend, the Thai official, and he said, well, don't talk to me, you do what you can do for that family. Because it's not my business. Because his business is to send us back, yeah. So Robert, one night, his people in the camp said, we have to escape you out because we just can't get you through legal route. So they took me out. And, you know, there's a big plan about that. We had to sneak out. We had to do the rehearsal, you know, sort of mental rehearsal. But we were so aware at the, you know, behind the camp where the barbed wire, they even cut the barbed wire, make it enough room for me to crawl out. And then the soil, the plan was made for me to crawl out there. And then somebody was waiting for me outside, in which house outside the camp, which we can see from far away, and take me to the train station, and the children had to be given a sleeping pill so they wouldn't talk. If they talk in Khmer, the Thai people, they would give the game away. From where we were, from the Thai border, Thai-Cambodian border to Bangkok, which was a long way, and we were stopped many times. The train stopped at, you know, every station. And at every station, we would see the guard, we would see police people. And my heart would jump and try to pretend to sleep and that kind of thing. However, eventually we reached Bangkok, where Robert were waiting. He took us straight away before any other people to the immigration office. So we were there as, you know, illegal immigrant, and what the Thai authority need to do is to deport us. So they choose that role. And by that time, Robert already get the television company to persuade the Home Office to accept us. So what we need to do is to try to get me deported as an illegal immigrant. And then the British people give us the visa, and that's how we're here.
When you came to the UK, how did you feel people reacted to you? Did you find that when you were here that you felt very much like a refugee? Did you integrate? And did people around you know that's why you were a refugee?
Well, it's a mixed feeling. You know, some people, you know, were really kind to us. They helped us, they gave us food, they gave us clothes. And Robert's organization, you know, were looking after us. So that side, you know, we have things to eat, we have roof over us, we have warm bed to be in. Although, you know, we were the four of us, me, my two daughters, and my sister, were in one room because they don't have, you know, enough space for us. But we were safe. We felt safe physically. But we received mixed reception from people. Some people understand it, maybe because I have two little kids, but some don't. I was, you know, I remember going, you know, in order to try to get a job because I didn't have any qualification here, so, and I didn't know what to do. So I said to the people who look after me, that I want to gain some kind of skill in order to look for a job eventually. So we decided that I should go and learn how to sew so I can, you know, curtain sewing, you know, alteration or whatever it is, while looking after the kid at the same time. So I went to do sewing courses at the adult education, and then one lady keep staring at me day after day. And one day, she plucked up the courage, I think, to come look at me very sternly and say to me, "Look, you should go back where you come from. England is so small to receive people like you." Okay? I don't know what to say. I didn't know what to say to reply back. I was just lumping my throat. I was just burst out crying. And I just walked out. Couldn't talk. So I told the teacher about what's going on. She, and I said, "I don't want to be here. If I could, I would feel happier to be in my country. But this why I'm here," I told her. And so, she's kind of passed on the message. And I think, from then on, nobody said anything to me, but it had kind of create self-consciousness in me. I look at people, although I persuaded myself that there are kind people, but there still are people who resented me being here. So you're sort of kind of conscious all the time, and that spoiled it for me. I lost my confidence. I lost my vibrancy toward life, To me, half of me, I live for my children, and the other half, because me being a positive person, I always be a positive person. So look, forget about it. You're here, concentrate on the good, concentrate on the kind people, and make the most of life. But the other side of me can't help but thinking that I'm old, I'm different, but at the same time, I try my best to be a good citizen of this country. I study to have a qualification. I went out to work rather than, let people see that I am a burden to the country, being on a dole and, that kind of thing. And I managed. I succeeded.
What do you do now?
I am an office manager for an IT organization, company. And my two daughters, one is a GP, and one is a law graduate. She is in Brussels right now. And I eventually married Robert, and we had a son together, and he's now one of the vice presidents for Barclay Capital Investment Bank in the Docklands. I think you pass on and your value to your children. You can't help it, but you can pass on. It's the only thing that give you better life is hardworking. Aiming, live your dream. Dream can one day come true.
Do you have anything you would like to learn?
Life to me, until now, I realize that life, problems and suffering are part of life. And suffering make you strong. Problem make you more creative. And me being a Christian, everything happened for a purpose. Through my experience, if you encounter problem, suffering, solve it as much as you could and carry on. And the way to find strength to carry on is to have faith in yourself, in whatever you believe in. In my case, I have faith in God. My survival through the ordeal in Cambodia under the Khmer rule is owed to God's love and protection. You have to have faith. That's all my message for people. Life is never been perfect. Everybody has problems. You know, when you have a problem, you thought, oh, why me? No, you're not the only one in this world who have problems. Everybody has problems. But people try to solve it one way or another. Hard to tell you the story because it brings back some kind of suffering, sadness, the feeling of helplessness, frustration, you know, and the horrible feeling of being killed, yeah? But I'm prepared to do it for one reason only, is to help people understand the way political people, you know, in order to get their sense of satisfaction or their aim, or they don't mind creating, you know, suffering for innocent people like me. And people all over the world need to know in order to avoid that genocide from happening again. And that is why I think your organization is the best organization to let the world know. So people are prepared. People know and try to avoid it so it won't happen again to other people in the world. Because Cambodia is not the only country that genocide like that happened.
Thank you for listening to this podcast by the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust. You can find more resources and information at www.hmd.org.uk.